Chapter 3. Early Life as a Sailor. A few days before my intended journey, I received an invitation to visit very intimate friends of my mother in Kent. Because of a coolness after my father's second marriage, I had heard nothing of them for many years. I obtained my father's permission to call on them, but I was very indifferent about it and sometimes thought of passing on. However, I went. I was known at first sight and met with the kindest reception as the child of a dear deceased friend. My friends had two daughters. The eldest, as I learned some years after, had been considered by her mother and mine as a future wife for me from the time of her birth. I do not say that my mother predicted what was to happen, yet there was something remarkable in the manner of its taking place. All intercourse between the families had been long broken off. I was going into a foreign country and only called to pay a hasty visit. This I should not have thought of, but for a message received just at that crisis, for I had not been invited before. The circumstances were precarious in the highest degree, and the event extraordinary. His future wife. Almost at the first sight of this girl, for she was then under 14, I felt an affection for her, which never abated or lost its influence a single moment in my heart. In degree, it equaled all that the writers of romance have imagined. In duration, it was unalterable. I soon lost all sense of religion and became deaf to the remonstrances of conscience. But none of the misery I experienced ever banished her a single hour from my waking thoughts for 7 years following. Hardly anything less than this violent and commanding passion would have been sufficient to awaken me from the dull, melancholy habit I had contracted. I was almost a misanthrope, notwithstanding I so much admired the pictures of virtue and benevolence as drawn by Lord Shaftesbury. Now my reluctance to active life was overcome, and I was willing to be or do anything which might accomplish my wishes at some future time. Restraining effect of love. When I later made shipwreck of faith, hope, and conscience, my love to this person was the only remaining principle which in any degree took their place. The bare possibility of seeing her again was the only means of restraining me from the most horrid designs against myself and others. But the ill effects it brought counterbalanced these advantages. Courtship is indeed a pleasing part of life, when there is mutual affection, the consent of friends, a reasonable prospect as to settlement, and when it is conducted in subordination to the will and fear of God. But when these concomitants are wanting, what we call love is the most tormenting passion and the most destructive in its consequences that can be named. And they were all wanting in my case. I dared not mention it to her friends or to my own, nor for a considerable time to her. I could make no proposals. It remained as a dark fire, locked up in my breast, which gave me constant uneasiness. It greatly weakened my sense of religion and opened the way for the entrance of infidel principles. Though it seemed to promise great things as an incentive to diligence and activity in life, in reality it performed nothing. I often considered what I would willingly do or suffer for the sake of her I loved. Yet I was incapable of forcing myself away from her company to improve opportunities. It did not prevent me from engaging in a long train of excess and riot, utterly unworthy of my honorable pretensions. And though, through the wonderful interposition of divine goodness, the maze of my follies was at length unraveled, I am sure I would not go through the same series of troubles again to possess all the treasures of the Indies. I now considered everything in a new light. I concluded it would be absolutely impossible to live at such a distance as Jamaica for a term of 4 or 5 years, and therefore determined that I would not go. I could not bear either to acquaint my father with the true reason, or to invent a false one. Therefore, without giving any notice to him why I did so, I stayed 3 weeks instead of 3 days in Kent. I thought the opportunity would be lost, and the ship would have sailed. I then returned to London. I had highly displeased my father by this disobedience, but he was more easily reconciled than I expected. In a little time I sailed with a friend of his to Venice. In this voyage I was exposed to the company and bad example of the common soldiers, among whom I ranked. Importunity and opportunity presenting every day, I once more began to relax from the sobriety and order which I had observed, in some degree for more than 2 years. I was sometimes pierced with sharp convictions. Though I made a few faint efforts to stop, I never recovered from this declension as I had from several before. I did not as yet turn out profligate, but I was making large strides toward total apostasy from God. The most remarkable warning I received, and the last, was a dream, which made a very strong, though not abiding, impression on my mind. The scene was the harbor of Venice, where we had lately been. I thought it was night, and my watch upon the dock. As I was walking to and fro by myself, someone brought me a ring, with an express charge to keep it carefully, assuring me that while I preserved that ring I should be happy and successful, but if I lost or parted with it, I must expect nothing but trouble and misery. I accepted the present and the terms willingly, not in the least doubting my own care to preserve it, and highly satisfied to have my happiness in my own keeping. Then a second person came to me, and observing the ring on my finger, took occasion to ask some questions concerning it. I readily told him its virtues. He expressed surprise at my weakness in expecting such effects from a ring. He reasoned with me some time, and at length urged me to throw the ring away. At first I was shocked at the proposal, but his insinuations prevailed. I began to reason and doubt, and at last plucked it off my finger and dropped it over the ship's side into the water. At the same instant, a terrible fire burst out from a range of the mountains, a part of the Alps which appeared at some distance behind the city of Venice. I saw the hills as distinctly as if awake, and they were all in flames. I perceived too late my folly. My tempter, with an air of insult, informed me that all the mercy of God in reserve for me was comprised in that ring, which I had willfully thrown away. I understood that I must now go with him to the burning mountains, and that all the flames I saw were kindled on my account. I trembled and was in a great agony, but my dream continued. As I stood self-condemned, without plea or hope, suddenly a third person, or the same who brought the ring at first, I am not certain which, came to me and demanded the cause of my grief. I told him plainly, confessing that I had ruined myself willfully and deserved no pity. He blamed my rashness, and asked if I should be wiser supposing I had my ring again. I could hardly answer, for I thought it was gone beyond recall. Indeed, I had not time to answer before I saw this unexpected friend go down under the water, just in the spot where I had dropped the ring. He soon returned, bringing it with him. The moment he came on board, the flames in the mountains were extinguished, and my seducer left me. Then was the prey taken from the hand of the mighty, and the lawful captive delivered. My fears were at an end, and with joy and gratitude I approached my kind deliverer to receive my ring again. But he refused to return it, and spoke to me, "If you should be entrusted with this ring again, you would very soon bring yourself into the same distress. You are not able to keep it, but I will preserve it for you. Whenever it is needful, I will produce it on your behalf." I awoke in a state of mind not easily to be described. I could hardly eat or sleep or transact my necessary business for 2 or 3 days. But the impression soon wore off, and I totally forgot it. It hardly occurred to my mind again until several years afterward. The time came when I found myself in circumstances very nearly resembling those suggested by this extraordinary dream, when I stood helpless and hopeless upon the brink of an awful eternity. Had the eyes of my mind been then opened, I should have seen my grand enemy, who had seduced me willfully to renounce and cast away my religious professions, and to involve myself in complicated crimes. I should probably have seen him pleased with my agonies, and waiting for permission to seize and bear away my soul to this place of torment. I should perhaps have seen likewise that Jesus, whom I had persecuted and defied, rebuking the adversary, challenging me for his own, as a brand plucked out of the fire, and saying, "Deliver him from going down into the pit, I have found a ransom." However, though I saw not these things, I found the benefit. I obtained mercy. The Lord answered for me in the day of my distress, and blessed be his name, he who restored the ring, or what was signified by it, vouchsafes to keep it. Oh, what an unspeakable comfort is this, that I am not in my own keeping. The Lord is my shepherd. I have been enabled to trust my all in his hands, and I know whom I have believed. Satan still desires to have me, that he may sift me as wheat, but my Savior has prayed for me, that my faith may not fail. Here is my security and power, a bulwark against which the gates of hell cannot prevail. But for this many a time and often, if possible, I should have ruined myself since my first deliverance. Nay, I should fall and stumble and perish still, after all that the Lord has done for me, if his faithfulness were not engaged in my behalf, to be my sun and shield even unto death. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Nothing very remarkable occurred in the following part of that voyage. I returned home in December 1743, and soon after repeated my visit to Kent, where I protracted my stay in the same imprudent manner as before. This again disappointed my father and almost provoked him to disown me. On board a man of war. Before anything suitable offered again, I was pressured, owing entirely to my own thoughtless conduct, which was all of a piece, and put on board a tender. It was at a critical juncture, when the French fleets were hovering on our coast, so that my father was unable to procure my release. In a few days I was sent on board the Harwich at the Nore. I entered here upon quite a new scene of life and endured much hardship for about a month. My father was then willing that I should remain in the Navy, as a war was daily expected, and procured a recommendation to the captain, who took me upon the quarter deck as a midshipman. I had now an easy life as to externals, and might have gained respect, but my mind was unsettled, and my behavior very indifferent. I met with companions who completed the ruin of my principles. I affected to talk of virtue, and was not so outwardly abandoned as afterward, yet my delight and habitual practice was wickedness. My chief intimate was a person of exceedingly good nature, natural talents, and much observation. He was the greatest master of what is called the free-thinking scheme, and knew how to insinuate his sentiments in the most plausible way. He could hardly have labored more in the cause if he had expected to gain heaven by it. This man, whom I honored as my master, and whose practice I adopted so eagerly, was overtaken in a voyage to Lisbon by a violent storm. The vessel and people escaped, but a great sea broke on board and swept him into eternity. Thus the Lord spares or punishes according to his sovereign pleasure. But to return, I was fond of his company. Having myself a smattering of books, I was eager enough to show my reading. He soon perceived that I had not wholly broken through the restraints of conscience, and therefore did not shock me at first with too broad intimations of his design. He rather spoke favorably of religion, but when he had gained my confidence, he began to speak plainer. Perceiving my ignorant attachment to the characteristics, he joined issue with me on that book and convinced me that I never understood it. He so plied me with objections and arguments that my depraved heart was soon gained, and I entered into his plan with all my spirit. Thus, like an unwary sailor who quits his port just before a rising storm, I renounced the hopes and comforts of the gospel at the very time when every other comfort was about to fail me. In December 1744, the Harwich was in the Downs, bound for the East Indies. The captain gave me liberty to go on shore for a day. Imprudently disregarding consequences, I took horse and followed the dictates of my restless passion to take a last leave of her I loved. I had little satisfaction in the interview, as I was sensible that I was taking pains to multiply my own troubles. The short time I could stay passed like a dream, and on New Year's Day, 1745, I returned to the ship. The captain was prevailed on to excuse my absence, but this rash step, especially as it was not the first liberty I had taken, highly displeased him and lost me his favor, which I never recovered. At length we sailed from Spithead with a very large fleet. We put into Torbay with a change of wind, but turning fair again, we sailed the next day. Several of our fleet were lost in attempting to leave that place. The following night, the whole fleet was greatly endangered on the coast of Cornwall by a storm from the southward. The darkness of the night and the number of the vessels occasioned much confusion and damage. Our ship, though several times in imminent danger of being run down by other vessels, escaped unhurt, but many suffered much, particularly the admiral. This occasioned our putting back to Plymouth. While we lay at Plymouth, I heard that my father, who had interest in some of the ships lately lost, had come down to Torbay. He had a connection at that time with the African Company. I thought if I could get to him, he might easily introduce me into that service, which would be better than pursuing a long, uncertain voyage to the East Indies. It was a maxim with me in those unhappy days, never to deliberate. The thought hardly occurred to me before I resolved to leave the ship at all events. I did so, and in the worst manner possible. I was sent one day in the boat to take care that none of the people deserted. But I betrayed my trust and went off myself. I knew not what road to take and dared not ask for fear of being suspected. Having some general idea of the country, I guessed right, and when I had traveled some miles, I found upon inquiry that I was on the road to Dartmouth. All went smoothly that day and part of the next. I had expected to be with my father in about 2 hours when I was met by a small party of soldiers. I could not avoid or deceive them. They brought me back to Plymouth and walked through the streets guarded like a felon. My heart was full of indignation, shame, and fear. I was confined 2 days in the guardhouse, then sent on board my ship, kept a while in irons, then publicly stripped and whipped, after which I was degraded from my office. All my former companions were forbidden to show me the least favor or even speak to me. As a midshipman, I have been entitled to some command, which, being haughty and vain, I had not been backward to exert. I was now brought down to a level with the lowest and exposed to the insults of all. My present situation was uncomfortable. My future prospects were still worse. The evils I suffered were likely to grow heavier every day. While my catastrophe was recent, the officers and my former shipmates were disposed to screen me from ill usage. But during the little time I remained with them afterward, I found they cooled very fast in their endeavors to protect me. Indeed, they could not avoid it without running a great risk of sharing with me. The captain, though in general a humane man who behaved very well to the ship's company, was almost implacable in his resentment when he had been greatly offended. He took several occasions to show himself so to me, and the voyage was to last for 5 years. I think nothing I either felt or feared distressed me so much as to see myself thus forcibly torn away from the object of my affections, under a great improbability of seeing her again, and a much greater of returning in such a manner as would give me hopes of seeing her mine. Thus, I was as miserable on all hands as could well be imagined. My breast was filled with the most excruciating passions, eager desire, bitter rage, and black despair. Every hour exposed me to some new insult and hardship, with no hope of relief or mitigation, no friend to take my part or to listen to my complaint. Inward or outward, I could perceive nothing but darkness and misery. I think no case, except that of a conscience wounded by the wrath of God, could be more dreadful than mine. I cannot express with what wishfulness and regret I cast my last look upon the English shore. I kept my eyes fixed upon it till it disappeared. When I could see it no longer, I was tempted to throw myself into the sea. According to the wicked system I had adopted, this would put a period to all my sorrows at once. But the secret hand of God restrained me.